some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's October 26, 2010. We have a New York craft beer scene show tonight. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, and my co-host is Ray Dieter from DBA. How you doing, Ray?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. The Saints lost this Sunday. I'm still pissed off about it.
So you guys have a really big Saints following now at DBA.
We do.
Williamsburg.
We have the New Orleans barbecue going on, and we have the Saints games on Sundays out in Brooklyn, and they really, really broke my heart this past weekend.
Well, I'm really impressed with what you've done over there. I saw in Time Out they had the big feature on it, New Orleans, you know, bars, New Orleans food and themes and bars, and they really called out, how do you pronounce the food that you serve?
Chop Chop.
Chop Chop.
Chop Chop, man. Simon Glenn is the chef that he's a good friend of mine from New Orleans that came up and is doing the Chop Chop, short for Chepatoulas, which is one of the major streets in New Orleans. And he's making great New Orleans cuisine we have. Man, today I had this pork belly slider. It was like it's just too stupid good to eat. And I wanted to have an andouille sausage sandwich. They ran out.
Oh, man, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
But I love how you guys have brought together DBA. You know, you've got your New Orleans connection because you have bars in New Orleans, and you've got your chef up here, and it's a really great place to hang out, especially on a Sunday with football. A couple of our guests tonight, we've got Seth and Mike from Beer Nation, which is a really interesting, would you call it a beer video, or is it beer TV? How do you describe yourselves?
Well, it's definitely beer video, but we would love to be on TV eventually. We'll have to see what happens. But right now, we're online, beernationshow.com, and you can see all of our episodes that are coming out every other Wednesday for as long as we can.
So I checked out some of the things that you have done, and you did a really cool interview with a bearded Shane Welch, the brewer from Six Point. Pretty cool. He looked like bearded Jesus, or it was either John Lennon or, you know, Brother Lennon or something.
Shane's got a beard now?
When they interviewed him.
Yeah, in 2009, last year, we caught him with a beard. And we just showed up, and he was bearded Shane. And, you know, some people were like, yo, I remember, dude, when you had that.
So when you were with him, what did you do? Did you make beer, or you just get a tour of the facilities?
That was the very first episode of Beer Nation. And we went out, me and Mike, we're exploring the craft beer revolution. That's our tagline. And we were started at Pacific Standard, and we talked to the guys, John and John, and then we went out to Six Point and pretty much just talked to Shane about what's going on right now. What's going on with the craft beer revolution, how it's exploding. And so he pretty much just gave us his story. We were in his brewery, and Mike actually did that. Mike, you were there.
Oh, yeah, I was there. And this was before they started farming, also on the roof.
That's a great brewery. It's got a lot of shit going on there.
Yeah, and they really feel there's something very Brooklyn about Six Point. It really feels like home. We like how they sort of concentrated on the local area, made sure that they convinced all the bars in the Brooklyn area first to cover, to carry their beers, and they just got a good vibe. And now they have this farm up there that they're cultivating some delicious vegetables and fruits, so clearly they know.
Check out lunch at sixpoint.com. Kathy Irway.
Yeah, Jimmy and I had lunch there. It was amazing. It was all fresh picked greens and vegetables. Yeah,
we got to make a beer this summer for the July Good Beer Month. We made a lightly smoked pale ale that was really popular.
Great day.
But I think that's a great thing that's happening in New York in the craft beer scene is Six Point, and they're doing a lot of custom beers too. And our other guest tonight is David Urbanos from the Ginger Man. It's not only an iconic bar, it's kind of, I think for a lot of us, it was one of the first places that we went and got to try a lot of different beers. Just, I would love you to tell us what the hell you do and what Ginger Man is and its relationships, because to some of us, it's a monster. It's huge. It's got multiple locations. On the other hand, it's this like New York icon. Tell us about it.
Well,
I've been dying to learn about it.
I've been there for approximately 6 years. So in that time, I've kind of evolved in what I do. Basically, I take care of most of the beer ordering. I've taught quite a few people that I work with or work for me kind of how to do that. The list is a bit daunting. We do carry 70 drafts, so constantly rotating those out is definitely something that's not an easy task, I guess. The choices that we make as far as what we carry, we don't really keep any consistent lines most of the time, basically because there's just so much good beer out there that you can't ignore anybody, you know, anymore. I think over the past couple of years, with the amount of breweries sort of becoming available and such, that it's just easier for us to get more and more beer. And being that we've been around so long and sort of helped create some of the craft movement as far as getting people involved in trying new beers.
Hey Dave, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Now, okay, because I'm a bar owner as well. And you guys have those taps lined up against the back wall.
Correct.
At the Ginger Man. So there's like a cooler behind that wall.
Yes.
And is it refrigerated?
Yes. It is. It's a massive cooler.
It must be crazy.
It is a little nuts. It gets a little crowded in there, to say the least. Yeah.
And also, I noticed that you sell mostly craft beer and great beer.
Yes.
And, you know, I've not been there in a while, but I remember you have great beer. But you also sell some, like, standard beers. Like, you know, I know you do have, like, Budweiser and stuff like that.
Yeah, we do have one line that we keep Bud Light on.
Does that sell?
It's actually one of our slowest movers.
Great.
Yes,
that's
great.
Exactly what I wanted to hear.
It's short sign at the end.
So why do you keep it then?
Honestly, I think it's more nostalgic than anything else. It's been on there
since
we've been open. It's I know that sounds a little weird, I guess, but honestly, we did drop it a few years back and told Anheuser-Busch, who said, "We'll put it back on the wall, but you need to get us an antique tap handle." And they actually did, but they had to go on eBay and buy one because they didn't have one.
Anheuser-Busch had to go to eBay to find their own tap handle.
Yes, they did. An antique tap handle for us, one of the originals.
I want to know more about Ginger Man. How did it start? You know, are there multiple owners? It's like an icon. Tell us about it.
There is actually only one original owner. We do not own the ones in Texas anymore. Those were sold a while back in the beginning of 2000. We also opened two up in Connecticut. Those have since sold as well to a longtime employee of Bob Precious. That's the owner. he has since then looked at opening up a new one in New Haven as well. So it's not like the name isn't growing, I guess.
So I mean, you started in Austin, right? Austin, Texas?
Houston, actually.
Houston.
Yes,
then
Houston,
Austin.
The first one. Yes, Houston, Austin, then Dallas.
So, but you're migrating north as opposed to
a little bit.
So,
yeah.
And who was the original owner?
Bob Precious is the original owner.
Bob.
Yes.
Nice guy. I've met him.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
And is he the owner? Who's the owner of the Manhattan location?
That would be Bob.
He's still Bob.
Yes, that would be the one that we own. So, yes.
Have you ever met him? Right.
Yeah, I have. He's always has a great haircut.
Oh yeah.
His hair is always perfect.
I think I met him once. He seemed like a pretty cool guy.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy. Yeah.
And did you guys open another bar across the street? Something
we did. That was called Under the Volcano.
Oh, that was like a tequila bar, right?
Yes. Yes, it was. Yeah, that was. It was
and
a nice
actually,
place.
You know, it's really funny. Mimi, who was a bartender at Under the Volcano, under the volcano.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
Right. She came down, and now we have a bar in New Orleans called Mimi's, and she actually is running that bar for us.
Oh, really? I did not know that. That's great.
I don't know if she was there when you were there.
I wasn't.
No, she wouldn't be. It was like 2003.
But what do you think about, you know, you must come in contact with as much good beer as we do, or even more with all those taps. I mean, first, do you guys move the beer?
We move a lot of beer.
But, yes. I mean, do you ever have lines that sit for 1 week and don't move?
Here and there. I would say we had more of an issue with that maybe 3-4 years ago. Anymore, not so much. You know, we put up a sour beer even 4 years ago, and it wasn't moving as fast as it does now. We put up a sour beer, we can't keep it on. It's maybe a day and a half, something
so
like that.
So we're going to go to Ginger Man later tonight, Tuesday. And what beer should I try? Say I want
Five beers at Ginger Man. Well, I can tell you this much. It's kind of hard for me to say because I'm not really even sure what we still have on based upon what I like. I would say some of the better beers we have an Ode Creek that's on the Ode Beer Cell Creek, which is really good in my opinion. We just put that on maybe a week ago.
That's not Belgian, right? Ago. The Ode Beer Cell.
So you've got like a lambic line that you used. Is it dedicated to that kind of that style of beer?
More or less. The thing is if some of the lines get ruined like that,
that's what I'm asking.
We'll just change out the whole line.
Because I choose not to put lambic beer online because it does mess up the lines.
Yeah.
So, and also, in Belgium, you don't really find lambic beer on draft. It's always in a bottle.
Right.
So I kind of stay away from that. Although, in New Orleans, we do have, we sell the Lindeman's Frambois online, and we sell tons of it on draft down there. It's against my better judgment, but I make mistakes all the time.
Cool. And what else? Ode Beerzel from Belgium. What else would I
that's
drink?
That's good. We usually, or at least almost always, have the Rodenbach Grand Cru over the Rodenbach on. I like the Grand Cru more myself because I just like a little more sour to it, a little more oomph. We usually have some decent pale ales, IPAs, imperial IPAs and such on. Right now we just tapped the Speakeasy The Don. They call it a triple IPA. It's an imperial IPA. It's really good.
Are you a hop man?
I'm a bit of a hophead, yes. Yes. I mean, there are days when I do need to scale back a little bit and have a Pilsner, but still nice little hop characteristic there. So.
Wow. And what? One more beer.
One more beer. Let's see. I would say like the Southern Tier Imperial Pumpkin, I guess, for the season.
Oh, yeah.
I like that a lot. That's, in my opinion, one of the best pumpkin beers out there. So.
That's cool.
That's the beer with the crust in it.
Yep.
Pumpkin.
Yeah, that's very interesting you say that, because I just had one of those the other night, and it definitely had a graham crackery smell.
Yeah.
I put mine up to my face, and I'm like, wait, there's cookie.
Yeah.
And then it's all spice and the pumpkin. But at first, I was like, what's that? But that makes perfect sense now. Yeah.
It's got the crust. It's got the pumpkin. It's got the spice. It's got everything in there.
Yeah, it's a pumpkin.
I think it's pumpkin, gentlemen. Pumpkin.
It is pumpkin. The king of pumpkins.
You poured us a beer, Seth. What is this beer?
This is my shout out to my boy, Second Floor Brewing, right in Williamsburg. This is his Double Wit from 09. He had a bottle left, and so he was like, "This is going to be the one."
It's a home brewer.
It's a home brewer. Yeah,
this nice.
It's a home brewer that has aspirations. All right, so he, we definitely love hanging out with him and drinking his good stuff. He kegs. He does little things here and there.
And he's just around the corner from Roberta's on Graham Avenue. So
oh, wow.
This is as local as it gets.
So is that part of what you guys do with Beer Nation? Are you checking out like all the little scenes, like homebrewing and everything else?
Yeah, I think it's, we have a holistic approach to analyzing or sort of, exposing the craft beer revolution. We think like it happens in so many ways and there's so many facets to the revolution. So, homebrewing is just one part of it. But, we try to look at, restaurants, bars, breweries, home brewers, aficionados, bloggers, right.
Radio shows.
All right.
Right.
Well, you guys are pretty cool. And yeah. You got your, their production teams here. They're filming us as we speak.
Oh, that's why the lights are so bright today.
And that's why I wore a solid colored t-shirt. Yeah. I was coached to not wear stripes.
It's funny you guys mention the camera because that's actually a fake. It's made of cardboard. We bring that around because we tend to get more free stuff when there's somebody with a fake camera following us around.
All right.
I've done that.
Thanks for bringing the beer then. Yeah. Well, listen, and I want to talk more about Ginger Man because to me, like when I started, I had heard about it. I'd never been there. And I still haven't been there. I've never been there. I've wanted to go. I met Bob Precious. And when we started the Good Beer Seal, it might have been, I think we wanted to make our small bars get as much like Thunder as Ginger Man did. Because Ginger Man, when I first started, everyone was like, oh, you've been to Ginger Man, Ginger Man, Ginger Man. And it's like, well, that's great. But then there's so many other these great small bars too. And it's all part of the craft beer scene in New York. I think that having Ginger Man kind of motivated a lot of us. Like, a lot of people talk about Blind Tiger at DBA, but you see a couple of like iconic examples of these really great places, and you're like, wow, I want to have a place like that too. So, we appreciate that you guys are there, and Bob Precious is a great guy. Ray, let's ask another question of Ginger Man before we take a little short break here.
Yeah. So, You have all those lines. 60?
70.
70. 70 lines.
70, yes.
How do you manage that?
Well, it's a bit daunting, but we actually have a pretty good crew. I train all of my barbacks and such, and my
so managers. So, okay. So, does each line have like a style? Like, so this line runs out of the, you know, the pumpkin ale. You know, it's going to be, this is going to be a seasonal line. That line's going to be an IPA line. That's going to be a Weiss line. That's going to be a Belgian line.
A little bit. Some of it depends. As I said, it gets a little crowded back there, so sometimes it depends on what we can get over to that line.
Uh-huh.
And if it's something that has sort of coated the line or ruined the line.
Ruined? Like we're talking about
like
the
lambics,
right.
Yeah. Then we'll just change out that whole line. We
just rip out the rubber.
Take it right off.
Uh-huh.
And just run a whole new line down the weekend. Yeah,
so. That's a crazy man. I've got 16 lines. In both all my bars have 16 lines. And it's crazy trying to just curate that amount. I can't imagine 70.
Yeah, it's fun though. I mean, it's
fun.
It's a bit like a in retrospect, you look at it and it's kind of you kind of get to be a kid in a candy store, especially with the ordering and stuff.
Well, that's just business anyway. Like, we are kids in the candy store. Yeah. At the end of the day, we really are. But when you have to like make sure that these lines are completed and there's beer pouring from each one, because when a line's down, it looks really bad.
Exactly.
So you have to make sure that they're all functioning.
That's correct.
And they really only have 69 lines, because we know one
is right, Bud Light.
Bud Light.
Right.
So they only have to curate 69 lines, and I think that's on purpose. Maybe.
So it's the bar with 69 lines.
That's wow. Correct.
I love that number.
That's fun.
It's nice.
That's a good one. You know, with that, we're gonna take a short break here on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Beer Sessions on the Heritage Radio Network. Our sponsor is GreatBrewers.com. If you want to learn more about beer, events, and other things, go to GreatBrewers.com. And we're also supported by Good Beer Seal, GoodBeerSeal.com, an association of 27 New York City independently owned beer bars. Well, we have some great guests on tonight, Seth and Mike from Beer Nation, and David Urbanos from The Ginger Man, and a very special guest is here tonight, very well-known author from England, Carolyn Steele, author of Hungry City. She's an architect, teacher, and she was in New York for some special conferences and at Princeton and in New York City. We're happy to have you on the show tonight, Carolyn.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here.
And, you know, the reason we invite you on is not for your knowledge of architecture or planning or how food shapes cities, but you're here because you're English, and you're going to tell us about pubs and the Thames and these other things that we should know about, because we're still just learning. You know, in New York, we're still learning about beer, no matter how good our beer scene is. So many of the good beers that we get come from Europe and other places, and so we didn't grow up in a beer-making culture.
Mm.
So tell us about, you know, England and life and beer and pubs.
Well, I grew up in central London, and basically when I was a kid, London smelt of hops, particularly by the river. I mean, because all the breweries obviously were down on the river using the water from the river. And honestly, if you sort of went through those areas, it was just like, you know, you were breathing beer. I mean,
they're making beer from the Thames water.
Well, I think they were using it for their cooling processes, but obviously originally they were, you know, well, like, you tell me. I mean,
I don't know.
I mean, you know, people
I'm hoping
did.
It's a ground source.
I mean, they still do brew down by the river now. So
Of course.
But I just find it really fascinating that, I mean, smell has gone from our cities so much, you know. I mean, I actually... This is slightly off beer, but I mean, I used to live close to Sarson's vinegar factory, which is a very famous vinegar factory, sure. You know, as well in the 1980s. And that, you know, so the smells of food and so on have largely gone from the city. But actually beer obviously has some kind of staying power, because if you still go down to Chiswick in London past the Fuller's factory, beer is what you smell.
It's on the way from the airport.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. You know, stop on in.
and I have many times.
Okay.
Were there more breweries in London when you were younger?
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to sort of reach into the part of my brain that's normally inaccessible to remember what they're all called. But I mean, it was literally, you know, the river was dotted with these huge buildings. I mean, it's a fundamental part of what the city was. And of course, going back historically,
Young's is gone.
Yeah.
And Green King used to be in London.
That's right. Yeah.
And
I mean, there's a number of them. I mean, I don't know the names, but I mean, historically, you know, beer was basically what everyone drank. I mean,
and still do.
Well, that's also true. That's also true. But I mean, small beer. There's the term small beer. Basically used to be a sort of very mild, sort of non-alcoholic form, or, you know, very low in alcohol form of beer that people basically drank, you know, all day long, because of course the water was too, but we're going back a few hundred years, obviously, was too well, I mean, it was potentially going to kill you, so the beer was the better option.
Yeah, beer is always, that's why the pilgrims stopped in Boston, because they ran out of beer on the boat.
Yeah.
And they needed to brew.
Yeah.
So we had small beer, and Seth, you let us try a mild. Who made this beer?
This is Kelso Satisfaction. So we got it at Beer Craft and a growler of it, and is an English mild. And I don't know much about English milds, but small beer. I did just recently see that someone put out a small beer, and I think it was Anchor.
Anchor did, yes.
Yeah, they have
a couple years ago.
Yeah, and I when I was out in California, I noticed, and I was like, "What's that?" Because I don't think we even
did they call it small beer?
It was called small beer.
Yes, it was.
It was Anchor's small beer. Yeah,
it was really limited.
It's an uncommon term, like here. I've never heard of small beer before.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in England, if you say it's small beer, you mean it's kind of really not worth much. But I mean, of course, obviously, this is an alcoholic sort of inventing a language.
Right. We call that Bud Light here.
whoa! Alcoholics creating a language?
Well,
you gotta explain that comment.
Well, sorry. I mean, I'm just thinking on my feet here. But I mean, you know, if small beer is actually very low in alcohol, and then that comes to be associated with something that isn't really worth talking about, then, you know, you make your own conclusions. Basically, people are looking for a hit.
Well, we do know that small beer was what the average person drank a couple hundred years ago in England, and the stronger beers, which would have been just maybe a pale ale or something better, were reserved for, you know, people with money, you know. And the same with wine, whether they were drinking brandy or port, you know, and instead of some watered down wine. So I guess you have to pay for the good stuff.
You got to pay for the good stuff, Jimmy. Yeah.
And when did the porters fit in? I mean, wasn't there like the dark porter that came out? Was that even in England?
Yeah, no, that's English.
Okay.
I mean, I can't give you chapter and verse on this. But I mean, yes, it's a very, very thick, velvety kind of, you know, your lunch in a glass kind of beer, which was drunk. And yes, I mean, I guess that kind of thing. I mean, you know, London as a city, and it still is the case. I mean, I was saying to Jimmy earlier on, well, actually, I wasn't saying, but I am now going to say that my great uncle used to navigate around the UK by pubs. Because the
your great uncle.
I love him too. He left me all his
speed
cutlery.
How does a pub get on the highway?
Well, the thing is, they've all got these really characteristic names, you know. So pubs have these incredible names, like, you know, the Dog and Cat and the Caterpillar and Lettuce and the King George IV and all of that. And he literally just knew every pub on every journey he ever took. So he'd kind of say, well, you go up to the Queen's Head, turn left and go as far as the Pike and Duck, and then you hang a right and hit the bunch of grapes, and then it's just on the left. And I mean, it is actually still possible to navigate around the UK like this. I mean, I think at one time in the City of London, one in every three buildings was basically a purveyor of food and drink. So you can just imagine, it's like sort of beer central, really.
I got to say, when I traveled around England, the good beer guide from Camera, was always like the best guide to pubs. And I was there with my wife and my kids. We always found the best places. The King's Head, all the pub names that you mentioned.
Yeah.
There's every town.
Quite a few King's Heads.
A lot of King's Heads, a lot of Queen's Heads, a lot of Lions, whatever.
The Cheshire Cat.
Tons of Cheshire Cats.
Well, and they all have definite articles in front of them.
Right. Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
To be completely fair to the British, I mean... Let's not do that. No, yeah, right. I rarely am completely fair to the British, but I will at least attempt to do so right now. It seems that the term pub connotes something very different here in the States. I mean, here it's just the equivalent of a bar. Maybe it means there's a bit more dark wood inside the room. But I mean, in Britain, from my experience, it is sort of a meeting place. It's a place where the family goes. It's a place where you dine. It's a place
it's a public house.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting to me as well is that, historically, I mean, the pub which came out of the tavern culture, in fact, I think Jimmy's is probably a reenactment of that in New York. I was just thinking that yesterday, because the tavern owners used to preside over the tavern and they'd stay near the front door, which Jimmy seems to do, and they'd just greet everyone that came in and everyone knew them. And it was absolutely an extension of your house. I mean, you had to go and get beer to drink because, as I was saying, water was undrinkable.
Right.
So everybody went through there, and they serve food and you could basically hire rooms. I mean, it was an extension of people's houses.
It's like that in New York City as well, because we all live in these tiny little apartments and we don't have living rooms, and like a lot of people have roommates and they don't have a living room, so bars are their living room.
Absolutely.
And what's funny is I live in South Brooklyn, right next to the Gate, which is
great place.
Yeah, big place, a lot of great craft beer. They don't have a kitchen, but they have a huge stack of takeout menus and delivery menus,
right.
And it's very often, especially on a day like today, Tuesday, people would be sitting out at the pub, and they will order their food just as they would had they been home. But here they're with people.
We've been doing that for DBA for years.
Right,
a big list of menus from local restaurants,
and that is a beautiful garden to sit in as well. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
And let's talk more about the pub experience. I mean, let's pick your grandfather's favorite pub. And what would it be like? What would he eat? What would he drink?
I mean, it would be full of dark wood. it would be quiet. I mean, this is the really interesting thing, is that actually the really best pubs have this kind of warm sort of murmur of sound, because actually, people drinking good beer as opposed to the 70th line that we won't mention ever again. It's a kind of it's about conversation, and it's about that kind of conviviality. And I mean my favorite pubs actually tend to be in the countryside, where that you have these very tall backed kind of benches, which came again from the old taverns, because it gives you a bit even more coziness. And then people play things like shove halfpenny. Have you come across that game? Pub games, so draughts and shove halfpenny. Sorry, a halfpenny is half penny. So it's a coin, and you basically have this kind of chalked wooden board with kind of gradations on it, and you stick the coin half off the edge of the board, and you tap it with your finger, and you try and get it sitting between the lines, and you
score
points.
Fun.
It is fun,
definitely,
especially with beer. You basically you pass the evening in that way. It's a beautiful.
One of the things I love about the English pubs in the countryside is they have all these little rooms, these tiny little rooms, with a window. It's like you get your own little apartment when you go there.
Exactly.
And the food is amazing.
Exactly. Well, I mean, again, Samuel Pepys, who was this fantastic chronicler of life in London in the 17th century, I mean, he names 170 taverns by names. by name. And he talks about, you know, I mean, he said there's, you know, he used to sort of bump into a mate in the market and he just bought a sturgeon. I mean, you could buy a sturgeon in London in those days.
The fish, you mean?
The fish, yeah. Obviously not one of the kind of 18-foot jobs. And, well, maybe it was, I don't know. I mean, he might have been a strong guy. And he bumped into a mate of his and he said, let's just go to the tavern and get this cooked for us and we'll just hang out together. You know, so you could take food there to be cooked.
That's a great idea, Jimmy. Jimmy, I mean, you've got a kitchen, I don't. So, like, bring your own fish. Bring your own cows.
It has happened. I've had customers come back from a day of fishing on Long Island, and they're bringing like a big tuna or something. And we'll cook it up for them.
Yeah?
And then we'll sell some of it, too.
Oh, damn. I love that.
And we'll charge them for the plate.
I want to get a kitchen just so I can do that.
No, this is what the reason that I wanted Carolyn to come on the show is because, you know, everything we're doing is still so new, you know, pubs and you know, brewing beer in New York and all that. But, you know, England's been doing it for a long time. And I find it fascinating, everything you're saying. I think we're going to take a short break here again and we'll regroup, come back. We get some questions and more on Beer Sessions Radio. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. My co-host is Ray Dieter from DBA Bars. We've got some great guests tonight and our sponsor, GoodBeerSeal.com and GreatBrewers.com. We've got a call-in question from a listener. It's Bill C. I don't know where he's from. He called in and asked a couple questions before, and I'm going to read it off to you. He said, I recently came out to my family as a... Now, this is kind of a weird question. I don't know about coming out to your family. I came out to my family as a craft beer drinker when I brought some Green Flash to a family event.
I've yet to do that. I'm scared.
This was 6 weeks ago, and they are still making fun of me and wouldn't even try it. I don't think I can suck it up and drink another can, of course. Can you recommend a craft beer that isn't so threatening to my family of macro lovers?
You know, can I jump in here, Jimmy?
Sure, man.
I was in Boston for the past few days, and I just came back on the Amtrak, and I got to tell you, it's got something to do with this question, but they have a craft brew on the train, and what they had was Dogfish Head 90 Minute. Jeez. On the train, which is 10% alcohol by volume. I'm like, that's your... I was like, Sam Adams Lager? Okay, I'll have that. Mm-hmm. But they had... Dogfish fucking 90.
So who's buying the beer?
No, I bought it.
Who's the beer buyer for them?
I don't know. I love this guy, whoever it is.
Yeah.
I had three of them.
So you're happy that they had that?
Yeah.
Oh, you're not criticizing.
No, yeah. I'm not criticizing. No, I'm thrilled. No, it's...
But it doesn't seem like a train beer. And I totally hear you. It's like a lot of people be like, oh my God, what is that?
Dogfish hit 90 minutes on a train, on the Amtrak.
Well, you know what it is? Let's talk about Bill C's question.
Yeah, sure.
You know what it is? It's maybe bringing, you know, a stronger beer into a group of non-beer drinkers, you know, might not be the way to go. Maybe he has to start with a really well-made session beer or a small beer or something that's accessible but still really well-made.
You know, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale is a great
classic
intro beer.
I remember I read about how you guys got interested in beer, Mike and Seth. What were some of the first beers that you had? What I never want to ask on the show is, I don't care about your first beer, because it's all the same, and it tells you how boring American beer culture used to be.
Yeah, it was a 40 a crazy.
Yeah, and we don't.
But you won't ask it
because it's everyone has the same answer. It's not like Carolyn, who's, you know, grew up and going to all these great pubs and all these. But tell us your first real beer that you drank.
Sure. I think the first real beer I had was Saranac. Either the black and tan or the pale ale. Seth and I met in college. We went to college in upstate New York, and that Matt Brewery was up there, and
FX Matt.
That's right, FX Matt brewing Saranac brews, and I think that was the first one. But actually, it was Sierra Nevada not long after that. That was my gateway, right. And then I think Sierra Nevada was the first real punch in the gut.
Anchor Liberty Pale Ale.
Yeah, that was yeah, and Anchor came quickly after that.
I remember Sierra Nevada. That was and Brooklyn Lager too. I mean, those are some beers that you start saying, "Wow, this is a good beer. I want that just to drink separate." It's not like I have to choose between vodka, tonic, and whatever, and a beer. It's like, oh, I want Brooklyn Lager. I want Sierra Nevada Pale Ale.
But then you have Cantillon, and it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that's your. Yeah.
It's just like, is this beer or am I in heaven?
Well, one of the things I was thinking about it was Scott's question, Steve.
No.
Bill C.
From somewhere in America.
Of course. Bill C's question. One thing I thought of immediately was Dale's Pale Ale because it comes in a can. And I think that may be a little bit less threatening.
It's very accessible.
When you're hanging around. Yes. Yeah. It looks, I think it looks, like a common man's beer because it's in a can. So that may be less.
Well, there's Butternut's Pork Slab. I mean, there's a lot of beers in cans. Sly Fox has beers
Sly
in cans.
Yeah. Yep.
We've had a whole show about talking about beer in can. And in some ways, it's actually better for beer because it doesn't allow any light in.
Right.
So cans aren't such a bad way to go.
And it's environmentally friendly because it travels lighter. Because the cans are lighter when they ship them, it takes they use less fuel than they would had they used bottles.
Hey, David, why don't you give us your input on this question? What would you recommend to Bill? What beers could he bring home and
enjoy it?
Not alienate his Coors family?
I would say most of the time we'll put up something that's sort of easy to drink, slightly sweeter. A lot of like the amber lagers or Vienna lagers, like Blue Point Toasted is one. Blue Point Toasted, like
that's accessible. That's a good one.
Brooklyn Lager, definitely. He has a good point with the cans. We don't really carry cans, but we usually have something like Oscar Blues on the wall because it's a pretty easy pale ale to deal
on
with.
On the wall? What's that mean?
On the draft wall.
On the draft wall? Oh, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry. And we do carry some sort of, I call them transition beers for people.
Right.
And some people might question why we have those. And speaking of the 70th line, that actually does push people into drinking something else. And, hey, how about you try this? Maybe a Spaten Lager, Hofbräu Original, something like that. So it does push people in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, and you do have to be careful with Oscar Blues because if you tell someone, the Dale's from Oscar Blues, and they come home with a 1056 and a Gordon 6, and then, the family is, what are you talking about? This is insane!
No, it gets crazy.
Yeah. The Gubna, great.
The Gubna's nuts!
Some great beers.
What's it? There's like onions in that shit, right?
I don't know. They're not going to tell us. They're not going to tell us.
But this is a good question because I used to drink a lot of wine too, and I'd have the same problem. You
don't need
bring I drink more beer now, but you go home with a bigger wine or something that you find really interesting, and you go into like an average dinner setting, and those people aren't drinking good beer or wine every day like those of us in industry get to, and they just want to have something really simple and straightforward. So that's a good question because it does relate to what we're talking about on our shows, what we're selling in our bars, and what people can buy. And I'm happy to talk about that. And Carolyn probably has more to say about it. What was one of the first real beers you had? And
Well, I mean, interestingly, I probably had my sort of, if it was an epiphanic beer moment, in Ireland rather than in England. I remember going over there and drinking Murphy's, which is this kind of... I had a beer epiphany.
Beer epiphany.
So, yeah. Murphy's, which was... I don't know how it sort of scores in the scale of sanctity sitting in the room with you guys. It scores well. Excellent. But it was very, very delicious. And I remember... those kind of holidays where you think you're going to spend a week walking and talking and sort of looking at moo cows, and actually it turns into a kind of beer fest.
Are there other kind of cows other than moo cows?
Well, the moo cows, The cows that go...
A lot of cows in Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of cows in Ireland, and they make fantastic butter.
And donkeys. A lot of donkeys in Ireland.
I don't know how many donkeys are there now. But yeah, I really want to pick up on that question because it's really, really interesting. And I've just realised something. I think the difference between bad beer and good beer is extreme. And the beer I'm drinking right here now is completely delicious. The beer that Seth brought in earlier
Kelso Satisfaction.
Thank you. Yeah, is absolutely delicious. And frankly, if you could walk into an average pub in the UK and just, you know, get that stuff, you know, that was like a baseline, I think, you know, we'd be drinking a lot more beer and I'd be drinking a lot more beer. But the truth is that, you know, that is not the case. And I think a glass of bad beer is more off-putting than a glass of bad wine. You know, so the entry point into beer is really critical.
That's great. Yeah, you're right.
About the difference between beer in Britain and beer here in the States. I had a friend from Bishop's Castle, England, just here 2 weeks ago, and I was trying to impress him with all these craft beers. And he was alarmed by how carbonated the beer is here. He just thought that it interfered with the flavor. Do you find that?
No.
Fantastic.
No, I mean, I think this is really delicious, but... I find that interesting as well. I mean, I think actually a lot of bad, very carbonated beer is sold in England as well. So, of course, we're basing an entire sort of national culture on the evidence of your friend's taste. So,
right. When you're in England, I mean, do you necessarily drink? Is all beer cask conditioned beer, or is some of the beer come out of a draft and it has carbonation?
Quite a lot of it is carbonated, but I mean, don't get me on the technicals. I mean, you know.
Hey, Jimmy, in England, very few pubs actually have hand-drawn beer. It's mostly on CO2.
Yeah.
It just is that way.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Stella, Kronenbourg.
Yeah.
What's that? The Dutch?
Carlsberg.
Carlsberg. You know,
I was in Amsterdam last year. Another side note, but the same thing. I was just alarmed at how bad the beer was.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like Heineken, and one or two others.
But I got to say something.
On draft.
I got to say something about Heineken. I just want to put it out there. I had Heineken when I was in Holland.
At the brewery?
No, oh. I didn't go to the brewery.
Okay.
But I was just at a pub and then had Heineken on draft. And I think Heineken is one of the worst beers in the world here in America. Well, the worst beer in America, I don't know what it is. But I don't like it here. And I went to Holland and I had it. It was delicious. It was like, well, delicious is a big word. But it was a really good lager. It was definitely a serviceable lager with flavor and hops and what I'm looking for in a lager. I've never had that same beer here in America.
Yeah.
And I think it's about that green bottle.
It might be. What I meant to say, though, is that I would expect that I would be able to walk around a city like Amsterdam and at least find, you know, every other bar would have, like, you know, a choice of a couple different styles of beer. And they pretty much all had pils on draft. And there was one Gulpener that was better than the rest. But after I couldn't drink more than two or three of their Heinekens on draft. After a while, there was some kind of weird aftertaste. So that failed the palate taste. Mm. You know, you have that your palate knows if it's good or not. And after two beers, you're like, this is not a good beer.
Are you sure that wasn't the pot, Jimmy?
it's a beer show, bro. No 420 on this show, but
Jimmy, you know, I've got the bar for you the next time you're in Amsterdam. Just a year ago, I visited and I went to a brand new bar called Beer Temple, and it is the according to the owner who I had the chance to interview, it is the first and only American craft beer bar.
There.
Yeah,
he also owns Aaron's Nest.
That's right, which is the bar where
which
you
is
can
good.
Taste
but what
all
I'm trying to say,
beers.
What I'm trying to say though, is separate from that. Even Beer Temple, it was okay.
Right.
It was nothing like a New York City craft beer bar.
No.
And let's bring it back to that, because this, I think what I'm trying to say, I'm sure it's the same way in England from what you're saying, is that here in New York City now, there must be, you know, there's definitely 27 good beer seal bars, but there must be, you know, hundreds of places you can go and get it. Even a regular bar in my neighborhood now, I can always get at least two good drafts.
Seth and I have always said, listen, we're really impressed when we come across a place like DBA or Jimmy's or Blind Tiger or Pacific Standard, et cetera, that really does show us something about you know, craft beer revolution. However, it really is when, like, these normal bars, the neighborhood bars, they choose to include local craft beers on three of the five of their taps, where I'm really impressed with where this is going.
And, you know, that's new, too, because, I've had this conversation 1,000 times. There was a time in New York City when there wasn't that much great
local beer. Now there is. Now
even a few years ago, you couldn't go into most bars and get good draft.
No, because it wasn't that good.
But the reason it's great talking about English pubs and things, that they had the tradition. That in Europe, too, they had the tradition of good beer, and now they've gone to macros. It's like they've got Stella and Kronenbourg and Heineken, and you can't get a good beer in most bars in Europe. But in New York, it's and a lot of the beers being made in Europe are made for America. You know, a lot of the small breweries, McKellar and all these small Belgian breweries, they're brewing for American market.
BrewDog, I don't know if they're...
BrewDog, Nomneo, there's all the great brands that we get in New York that we want to collect and drink. They're really made for the American market.
And I wonder if those beers are also available in the rest of the country. Like, we're so close to Europe because we're in New York. We're on that side of the coast.
From what I've heard, you know, Brian Ewing from 12% Imports.
Brian's great.
You know, he's kind of like the man on the street because he's doing direct importing. And he's in several cities now. He's definitely in San Francisco and Chicago and Philadelphia at least. And he says the way he does it is that, you know, he finds a place, whether a restaurant or a bar, that is interested in serving good beer, and he finds, you know, who the better distributor is there. Next thing you know, he's got in these other cities. There are people. The demand is out there.
Right.
You know, Boston. I mean, anywhere that's having a craft beer week or anything. I mean, I don't. San Diego. I don't think that it's limited to New York at all. And maybe West Coast has more West Coast beer, but I'm saying it's great. And I think the real theme of this was talking about how great the New York City, you know, craft beer scene is, you know, the number of great bars serving beer. And, you know, hopefully, I think the one thing that's missing is we really need some more small breweries. And hopefully a buddy from Second Floor can go legal.
That sounds great. You know, I would love that.
There's some, we've got, on Long Island now, there's Barrier Brewing, there's Blind Bat, there's something, something.
Greenport just opened up.
Greenport's like, they're doing great.
Yeah, and they're like a legit microbrewery. They're set up. But these other guys, like the Nanos, you know, we need some more local breweries.
Totally.
We really don't have enough, and we don't really have New York styles yet, so it's really exciting. I figure I think the way things go in New York, it's going to be about, in 2 years, it'll be like 20 years anywhere else. It'll be like,
New York style beers.
There's like, you know, there's English ales and, you know, German pilsners. We don't really have a New York style beer yet.
What do you think that would be, Jimmy?
Well, I think that's up to the brewers.
Because we got a history of English, we got a history of German, we got a history of all these countries.
Yeah. Let's do a poll. What would you guys, okay, start with Ray. What would your, if there was going to be a New York style of beer, what would it be?
Oh, now I'm on the spot. It would be a German lager with a bit of hops, local hops. It'd be all local. Local ingredients.
I'm thinking a little pizza, lox, bagel combo beer. That's what I'm thinking. Maybe that's possible. I'll talk to my boy. Talk to Brad about it.
Get your buddy on. What does he say? What would the New York beer be?
I'm going to go with Belgo IPA. I think
Belgo? What? You remember Belgo, that restaurant?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah,
what are you talking about?
No, but Belgian style IPA.
Oh.
I think it would be good because this is a crossroads of Europe, of old and new world, and the West Coast IPA, which has become, you know, the American style of IPA.
Whatever.
Okay, David from Ginger Man.
I honestly would like to see it be some sort of a sort of an amped up pilsner, not quite an imperial pilsner, but not quite a regular pilsner. You know, something with a little bit of oomph, but still sessionable. Sit down, drink a few.
Good one. Carolyn?
Oh, right. Well, you know, what's interesting is that the thing I think it shouldn't be is a kind of lowest common denominator amalgamation of, you know, a whole series of different things. And, I mean, for me, New York's got this incredibly distinct character. And it's got this, what I would say is a combination of toughness and warmth. You know, that's what I feel from the city. So I would like to see that in the beer. But, I mean, that's a bit abstract, but I can't talk technicalities.
No, that's good. I like
say.
That.
All right.
Mm. A less abstract way of saying that is Belgo IPA.
Okay.
Belgo!
And I'll put in a specific beer. They've made it under the guise of several names. Now they're calling it 6 Point Atlantic Amber. And I think that, to me, would be like, if you had to say there was a New York style of beer, I would say that. Because it's a pale ale, but it's lightly hopped. So it's kind of like not quite an IPA, but it's you can drink it in place of many IPAs. And it's also someone who wants an ale. Anyways, 6 Point Atlantic. I don't know. What else would
be? I love that beer that we did
In the springtime over at Six Point, that smoky beer. Well,
it's almost the same. I think it's the same beer.
Oh, really?
It's like their ale with this one had a little more hops, and the one we had a little smoked malt. So
I love that smoky. I mean, I think that smoky beer is wonderful. Like Spezial, I love that stuff.
Well, why can't Six Point? I mean, a nice ale is really good. You know, why do you have to make a double IPA? Why can't you just make a nice ale with a hint of hops or a hint of smoke?
Yeah. So you're thinking the Rausch. You're thinking Rausch is New York. Smoky, yes.
It was edge. It was the opposite. It was a subtle smoke.
Oh,
so there was only a hint of the smoke.
Rah.
Yeah.
No, not Rausch. Just rah.
They called it Signal.
That's the hipster one.
It was called Signal, as in smoke signal, but they didn't put smoke on the word because it wasn't smoky
enough.
Yeah. So, but Six
Point,
you know,
damn good.
And it's a challenge out there. You know, everybody's making styles, and I think that Six Point, if anyone, is kind of leading the way in setting the styles. You know, they're doing some great. Have you had their Belgian style beers?
Yes, no, I have. Yeah,
yeah. Right now they're out with, they have a Belgian style rye, a Belgian IPA, and one called Reaction, which is like a stronger ale. And
I think they have the Rippa here. No, not the Rippa. The Bipa is here. The Belgian IPAs here at Roberta's. I think
so. They have the German style line too. But, okay. You know, I think they're really. You know, but that's Six Point, you know, and anyways, I'm putting a call out there. We need more New York beers.
I think I'm drinking whiskey tonight instead.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, that's what New York is. You can get everything. So, you know, and who knows if they make medical marijuana available in New Jersey, you know, it might compete with our
How
bars.
About that? Who would have believed that would have happened?
I do like
what you said, Ray, about having a real local beer, though. Like, I would love the idea. We had a telephone guest or whatever. Someone, we did an interview by phone a few weeks ago with a malt company in Hadley, Massachusetts, which is pretty rare because we're talking about the building blocks of beer. Everyone talks about hops, but they're one of the few people in the whole East Coast who are making their own malt. I mean, usually it's a pretty big operation. It's like West Coast or Bamberg. Yeah. And that they're really going on a limb. They're being risking it. You don't hear about anyone growing local wheat, you know, or barley or whatever your building blocks of beer are.
Local weed?
Yeah, wheat.
Oh, sorry.
But so I think that if anything, I would love to see, you know, this local movement grow. You know, and you're making beer from, you know, local ingredients. And then we'll see. Who knows? There might be a, you know, I think one thing about local style, you know, in England, that on Burton-on-Trent, is that where Bass is from?
Yes.
One thing that made the beer was the water. So that's a local
Correct.
Ingredient.
It's a pH. It's the actual water content.
So they do know that you know, one, New York always had good water. So.
Yeah, and that's why I was giving a lot of crap to Sam Smith when he was here a few weeks ago. About sending us
Samuel Smith,
beer.
The seventh, yeah. was on the show.
Samuel Smith, the seventh generation of Samuel Smiths, was here in this studio. And all I want to do is get his casks to America. that's my job from now on. That's what I do. That's my reason for living, to have Samuel Smith's casks in America.
Well, that's a good challenge.
Yeah.
You know, and I get a feeling we're going to do a lot more with this whole crew. Beer Nation's here tonight. We're going to, you know, probably do some interviews. It's great to have the Ginger Man on. Carolyn Steele, I think we're going to at some point take a trip to England and visit her and Sam Smith. I'll give you a little heads up, too. You know, greatbrewers.com is our sponsor. Check out goodbeerseal.com. We've got a frequent guest on Beer Sessions Radio, Chuck Duffney. He wrote an article for the Good Beer Seal about how he brews beer to suit the taste of his friends. So check it out, goodbeerseal.com. And thanks so much for listening to Beer Sessions Radio. You can find Beer Sessions Radio on Facebook. Friend us, share beer thoughts, and all that. Thanks to Ray, Seth, Mike, Carolyn, David for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor, and engineer Nat Wiener. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow.